Inside the Cross Podcast.
Welcome back to another edition of the Inside Lacrosse Division One Men's Podcast with your host Dan Flynn and the incomparable T Foy Terrence Foy.
That's right, T Fly. Thanks for making this happen.
Yeah, sure.
All you're doing.
Yeah, I didn't mean to inconvenience you yesterday.
So for those of you that did not follow the tete-a-tete on Twitter, typically we record this on Monday afternoon. We agreed to reschedule to Monday morning in order to accommodate Dan's plan to attend Orioles opening day. And you know what, Dan? I think that everything smiled upon us. I was unable to make it to the pre-agreed recording time. But by virtue of that, we were able to talk about what was one of the most memorable endings to any college basketball game ever. Probably going to be a top five sports moment of 2016. And just an all-around unbelievable evening for Villanova fans, Villanova basketball fans in particular. You are a familiar Duke basketball fan.
Yeah, you bring that up every week for some reason.
Because I enjoy it so much. Were you cheering against North Carolina or for Villanova?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I certainly didn't want North Carolina to win, although they were deserving of it. Neither team lost that game, but I was definitely rooting for Villanova. As you know, Terry, my wife, Amy, worked at Villanova in the athletic department for a few years and got to know the coaching staff and a lot of the other administrators there. And I, to some lesser extent, I did as well, just visiting and coming to some games. And great people there. And Jay Wright is a really good coach and a nice guy. He's been really nice to my wife. And he's got a good family. His kids also went to the same school, high school, that my nieces and nephews went. They were classmates. And it's good, great family, the Wright family. And very happy for them. Very happy for them. More than I would have thought. Like, after the game, that's what I was saying. I was like, wow, that guy deserves to be the champion.
It's a remarkable change in perception nationally, given the fact that prior to this, he was kind of viewed in a John Donowski can't win the big one type of way. And let's work in reverse. And I just can't move on before saying this is the reason that we're doing this podcast, because of gems like the relationship with the Wright family that Dan Flynn possesses. But so let's start with Jay Wright's reaction to a historic game-winning shot.
There was no reaction. And that was the craziest part.
It was widely celebrated. And while it was very cool, because it's impossible to imagine myself not reacting to winning my first national championship via a buzzer-beating three, what did you take away from it? Did that deserve to be as celebrated as it was?
Well, I imagine that you dream of that moment for your whole coaching career. I mean, that's got to be the crowning achievement in his coaching career or of his professional career. So I imagine he had thought, you don't get to be that successful without dreaming and envisioning yourself winning a national championship. That's how you run a program to get there. You don't only have to believe it yourself, but you got to make all your team, your administrators, your whole staff, your school buy into it. So I imagine he's thought about that. At the same time, we also celebrate things like Jimmy V when they won the championship and he's running around looking for a guy to hug. Like, those are moments that we talk about. So the way it was, the media reaction to it, Mike and Mike, they couldn't stop talking about this. Golic was beside himself that there was no reaction to by Jay Wright. And, I think Dick Vitale, they asked him this morning, and he gets excited about everything. And I think his comment was that, he is Jay Wright probably has a lot of respect for Roy Williams and what he was going through. And Roy was devastated by the loss, apparently, after the game. And, it was his respect for and admiration for Roy Williams that kept his stoic face. But I don't.
You mentioned one thing in there that I want to hit on, and that is that it's easier to convince your administration that you can win a national championship when you did win a national championship 31 years ago. Shout out to my boy, Raleigh Massimino, who late in his career took the head coaching job at Cleveland State and is a neighbor of your boy, T. Foy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Used to see him around town, heading to the grocery store, the bank, maybe church every once in a while. I really enjoyed that Mike Fratello was, hanging off of him. I thought, first of all, that he was going to shake Rally to death because he was like he was excited. Like all of Jay Wright's contained excitement was then transferred to Mike Fratello.
Rally did look stunned though.
He definitely
as if he's getting up there in years. He didn't. He kind of looked like he didn't know where he was for part of it, or he was just really into the moment. I can't tell. I can't speak for him, but he did. He had a look of befuddled amusement on his face.
Sticking with the theme of celebration, how did you feel about the Jordan reaction shots, both to the page three and then later to the loss?
I don't, again, as a Duke fan, I still think Michael Jordan's the greatest basketball player of all time. Love watching him play. Similar to what Tiger Woods has, in a way, done to golf, where, you know, it's, some people have told me, like, Michael Jordan ruined basketball because when he's not playing, it's just not as exciting. Obviously, it's been many years, and we've had some
pretty exciting players.
Some great players and the way the game is played now. But for me, at least a little bit, Tiger Woods has done that to golf, you know. So a lot of love for Michael Jordan. That being said, the crying Jordan thing, I don't even understand why that became a thing, why we're making fun of him. But it is funny to see how quick. I think that's it. I think they're stupid, but I think how fast it happens. Like there's people just waiting around with their Photoshop ready to go.
No, it's that they've got them pre-made. And they that's my favorite part.
Who's
like,
got time for that, Terry?
2 or 3 hours later, you see people tweeting like, man, it's a good thing that Carolina didn't win because I was about to tweet this at you. And then it was like their Jordan-faced crying meme that they just couldn't take out of the holster because the result did not match the theme of the meme.
I can't imagine having that much spare time to do some Photoshop work, hoping something will happen.
Yeah, well, I engaged. I'm not too big to admit it that I wanted to see somebody Photoshop Jordan crying onto Gus Johnson because I can only imagine how disappointed he was not to be able to call that. And then when Jim Nance received a fair amount of criticism for his,
yeah, you didn't like his call.
Actually, yeah, I mean it was just unintelligible. You didn't understand what he was saying. He seemed, and I can understand the problem in that situation when the confetti is falling and you're not certain that the game's actually over.
Yeah.
It makes for a very confusing scenario, but the TeamStream guys didn't have that problem.
Well, what about
bars across Philadelphia didn't have that problem?
No, I was driving in here. They made 6 arrests, and there were 25 people injured outside on the main line last night, which is I still don't understand the let's burn something because we just won. I don't get that. I never have.
I have to plead the fifth. I got a main line story that I'm just not ready to share yet.
Okay. But it really was a remarkable ending to the game, and you know neither team deserved to lose, or both teams were deserving of winning. And they played championship basketball, and the last shot, just the composure and the poise of Archie Diacono to come down, and they ran a play for him. He didn't see it, and Jenkins was following up, and then Jenkins just drained it. So it was awesome. And I was in a bar watching it, and there were some sad-faced Carolina fans. This one guy was wearing a Bryce Johnson jersey and just, he was devastated. Like, he didn't know what happened.
So there are a couple of things about this game that I want to, correlations or corollaries that I want to draw to lacrosse. Just in terms of lessons, I think, our fearless leader, Matt Kinnear, tasked us with this, and it's not going to make its way into the magazine because we don't have the space, but that doesn't mean it should go to waste. The first point that I would start with as it relates to Villanova and kind of relates to the Villanova lacrosse team is that shooting can overcome everything. They were the third best field goal percentage team in Division I basketball for the year.
And they set a record, a tournament record. They have 58% for 6 games.
It's amazing.
That's on fire.
So while I was impressed at times and with their defensive pressure and their rebounding.
And a team that shoots a lot of threes, and they still shot 58% from the floor.
Ultimately, and certainly the Golden State Warriors have laid this model out in excess over the last year and a half, but in basketball, as in lacrosse, if you shoot better than your opponent, whether it be more effectively from greater distance with more creativity, it's going to overcome a lot of ills. So just a reminder to all of the lacrosse teams out there, spend a lot of time shooting. The second point that I was going to sink my teeth into as it relates to Villanova is, you know, they were – I was surprised by the line that they were only 2-point underdogs because I thought Carolina was considerably better than them. It goes back to the point that you made earlier about believing that you can win, and particularly for a program that oftentimes is told that it shouldn't be able to win or can't win. There was something about this that reminded me of the 2012 Loyola Championship insofar as it was a team that had a pretty good pedigree in its respective sport, dating back, and that laid the groundwork to being able to be, you know, a quote-unquote mid-major national title contender. And the difference, obviously, is that Villanova has been building toward this, whereas, you know, injuries meant that Loyola missed the postseason in 2011. But, you know, I just thought that that was, like, kind of an interesting corollary. It comes back to belief in a lot of instances, and I thought that Villanova clearly exhibited, not just in terms of being able to overcome not being a one seed, you know, score a tremendous victory over the one seed in their region in the NCAA tournament, and then overcome what could have been a debilitating game-tying three-pointer that, had the game gone to overtime, it's pretty easy to imagine Villanova not being able to bounce back from that. You know, those three instances of belief were integral to their success, and I just think that it's a point not worth missing.
Yeah. There is a lesson to be learned. You were referencing Matt Kinnear, wanted to do something on a lot of the final four, eight teams are their lacrosse counterparts at their respective schools are vying for the same, and you know, taking a lesson from each of their teams on the basketball side and applying it to lacrosse, is there's a lot to be said. So, for instance, like UNC men, you know, their basketball team had a couple of stumbles throughout the season, and it's just believing in yourself and getting better all the time. They peaked at the right time towards the end of the season and really rolled into the tournament. I think they won every game in the tournament by double digits. So did Villanova.
There was a point in the national championship game when they fell behind by five. It was the most they had trailed by in the tournament to that point.
You know, the Syracuse men and women's basketball teams. The women's, I think, are playing UConn tonight for the national championship. And the men's team obviously made it to the Final Four. And I think the lessons for their lacrosse programs are, look, it doesn't matter. Just keep battling. You know, you overcome obstacles, get hot at the right time, which we've seen the Orange do a lot in lacrosse. Get ready, use the regular season as a launching pad for their May success.
And I think that as we round this portion of the season into conference play in earnest and then toward teams winning automatic qualifiers or positioning themselves in an at-large conversation, it's definitely going to be a point of focus of this podcast going forward. It's one of my favorite things to, you know, track the bracketology conversation, and we will do that in subsequent podcasts. But let's dive into the news.
Yeah. So you were up in Syracuse for their 100th celebration of the 100 years of Syracuse lacrosse.
I was, yeah. It was a really nice event on Friday evening. There was a lineup of speakers. I believe that there were 8 or 9. Cocktail hour at the On Center, which is the Syracuse Convention Center. Really, really nice display. Shout out to Matt Palin for leading the charge on that. And, you know, there were a couple of things that I took away from it. The first is, Syracuse as a town and as a sporting culture really reminds me of Cleveland. Has that Great Lakes feel to it. And so when I go there, it feels a little bit more like home. And the thing that I use as a lacrosse perspective from that is that their sports fan culture is so different from the other large programs in college lacrosse, primarily large and historic fan bases, primarily Johns Hopkins and Navy. And I think it's because – I think the thing that sticks out to me the most is that those two programs have tremendous loyalty among their alums and other folks that are affiliated with the program. But Syracuse's attachment to people that have never, you know, played lacrosse at all, or certainly not at Syracuse, is really, really strong. And I think that is the biggest source of separation. Syracuse lacrosse fans are members of the Syracuse community in a way that I don't think exists around the rest of the country.
Yeah, no, I think I understand what you're saying. In Baltimore, for instance, there's so many colleges, and some of them are literally next door to each other, like Loyola and Hopkins campus. And there, you sort of segregate it into like what group, your team you root for and stuff. But when you get up north of that Pennsylvania border, man, it's all Syracuse fans. And it's a culture that they grow up as fans. The program's pretty accessible, it seems like, for the community. And, you know, the dome is a nice warm place on a cold February or March day.
That was the other point that I was going to make. Their game day experience has, for so long, for 25 or 30 years, been what many universities are only catching up, many athletic departments are only catching up to now. I mean, there are stories of the air gate in the Carrier Dome in 1988-89, we're talking about 30 or almost 30 years ago, 28 years ago, there were TVs in suites that people were able to turn around sitting in the lower bowl and see a replay of the play on the TV. I mean, that's technology that didn't exist at most top 10 programs 10 years ago. So before you even factor in that it's a temperature controlled environment.
That sells beer.
That sells beer. That
also very popular with upstate everybody. New Yorkers.
It's easy to understand why they have one of the staunchest fan bases in the sport.
And you know what else helps you grow your fan base and keep your fans, Terry?
Being really good.
Yeah.
And winning. Playing a really exciting style.
Yeah, winning a lot of games. And they certainly do a lot of that. So you got to talk to a lot of the Syracuse greats, or you saw a lot of them?
Yeah, absolutely. Got an opportunity to shake hands, rub some elbows, did some on-camera interviews that'll be going up over the course of the next month as we transition what is the May issue of the magazine content online. Really excited about the feedback and moving forward with that project.
And you also, you said Coach Simmons sort of highlighted it and sort of closed down with the last one to speak.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously Slugger has a way with words that is rarely comparable. And I think that, you know, as the patriarch of the program, when you reflect on an 80-year life that, you know, had a probably six-decade career in some respect, even though he's been retired and away from the program in a formal capacity for 18 years, the amount of perspective that he can bring to the table in terms of the ascendance of the program as well as the groundwork and the cultural relevance is second to none. And that's before you even take into account the fact that he has such an artistic eye and can understand the meaning of the game and in its perspective in a way that very few other guys have the courage to do. You know, one of the anecdotes that he shared with us for the May issue was how important the connection is to him between Syracuse lacrosse and Scotland lacrosse, because he took his team to Scotland in the wake of the Lockerbie tragedy, and how influential that has been on the history of lacrosse in Scotland, and how important the recent success of that international team has been to him in terms of kind of a tip of the cap to what those trips meant.
He's definitely a legendary coach. He's one of the 11 honorees that the IMLCA is going to induct into their first Hall of Fame this May 28th in Philadelphia around Memorial Day weekend. Coach Simmons joins 10 other legends who will be inducted. And if you want to go to that event, and you can buy tickets on our website at insidethelacrosse.com/IMLCA.
Absolutely. Would highly recommend it because, you know, the tales that are going to be told on that night are going to be can't miss.
Yeah. On to something not as positive, Terry. There was an incident this weekend in the Brown-Princeton game that is...
So far, it's the biggest story in the sport this season so far. So, you know, where to begin? I guess for those of you that have not seen the video, it was coming out of halftime. I believe it was a 8-6 Brown lead, and a defensive midfielder who is on the field for faceoffs was running off of the field. And Princeton coach Chris Bates, who is well known for being somebody who is out of the coach's box on the field frequently, appears to have essentially stuck out his arm and elbow to hit John Yazzo Scaparata as he was running off of the field. There was already a flag down for a separate incident. Brown went on to score on that possession, and the flag was unrelated to Bates. I'm sorry. I think the score was actually 7-6 at that point. And that then led to a really impressive Brown run en route to a 19-8 victory. The game was broadcast on the Ivy League Digital Network and Watch ESPN app in the moment, a few folks noticed and noted the incident to us. And then the video of the incident made its way around the lacrosse circles very quietly and privately, I would say, on Saturday evening and throughout the day on Sunday. We reached out to the Princeton Athletic Department, knew that they were aware of the incident, and inquired as to whether there was a reaction or an outcome. And on Monday morning, they provided Inside Lacrosse with a statement saying that Coach Bass had been put on administrative leave as an investigation into the incident continued. This is the type of incident that can absolutely lead to a media firestorm, and I would say that in the first 24 hours, while there's been widespread interest and, you know, a lot of commentary associated with it, it hasn't, quote-unquote, blown up. Now, that being said, in the grander scheme, that doesn't really matter. You know, certainly as a lacrosse-specific industry, we're going to be focused on the way that the sport is perceived from a mainstream perspective. So that matters to us, but certainly doesn't matter to Princeton, doesn't matter to Coach Bates. Probably doesn't matter that much to the people listening to this podcast. There's a lot of context to this, and that's actually one of the comments that Coach Bates had in the wake of it. He told the Daily News that he didn't actually have a formal comment, except to say that there was more context than what was seen in a five-second video. And, you know, I want to color my comments with my perspective in terms of the context. So when I started full-time at Inside Lacrosse, the first game that I covered in 2008 was at Drexel. They were hosting Virginia. And to me, that kind of set the tone for my relationship with Chris that's, you know, spanned the last 8 years. He was, you know, very cordial and helpful in a day that featured a disappointing loss to a top program. And since then has been, you know, the type of guy that I've enjoyed talking to. I would not say that I know him well. That being said, I have not had a negative interaction. You know, that is compounded by the fact that he, after the 2009 season, took the head coaching job at Princeton, has been there for six full seasons. And is that right, Dan?
This is his seventh year.
Yeah. And has had middling results in comparison to his predecessor, who, you know,
one big
a legend, the type of guy that, you know, if he were done with his career, would be included in that inaugural IMLCA Hall of Fame class. He won six national championships at Princeton and made the decision to go to Denver, which to me says a lot about the type of job that he was leaving and what the future prospects of the Princeton program were. Chris Bates took the helm and has had two postseason appearances since and certainly not attained the postseason success that Bill Tierney had.
Yeah. He's two NCAA tournaments, three Ivy League championships, two he tied, but the Ivy League, if you tie, you were co-champions, where they were 4-2. He had 1 year where they were 6-0, and four Ivy League tournament final appearances, including one championship in his first 6 years.
Continuing on the professional track, one of the significant aspects of the program over the last 4 years has been a lot of turnover in terms of their assistant coaching staff.
Yeah. For different reasons, though.
Two guys left to become head coaches at other programs. One guy left for a medical reason. And now Matt Madelon, who came over from Stevens Tech, and Steve Grossi, who came over from Drexel, had been an assistant at St. Joe's, was a player for Bates at Drexel. You know, are those two will be leading the program, and it was a team that was 2-5 coming into this Brown game, had already had a little bit of controversy earlier in the season as Zach Currier was suspended in the wake of an incident with an official after their overtime loss to Hofstra. Certainly the Tigers had expectations higher than what they are now as they sit at 2-6 and 0-3 in Ivy League play. But it's still worth it to say that, you know, lying ahead, they have in the Ivy League Cornell, Harvard, and Dartmouth, three comparatively winnable games, certainly compared to Yale, Brown, and Penn, the three Ivy League losses that they already have. If Princeton were able to win all three of those games, they would qualify for the Ivy League tournament. If they were to win two and have some breaks the other way, they would be in contention to qualify for the Ivy League tournament. So it's also not to say that their season is completely over. All of that being said, if we had had this conversation last week, I would have expressed some skepticism that Chris Bates is going to return as the Princeton coach in 2017 anyhow.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a program with a rich history. And, you know, his last 3 years, he was 9-6, 3-3 in the Ivy League, 7-6, 2-4 in the Ivy League, and 9-6 and 4-2 in the Ivy League, and not making the NCAA tournament. Is the fans at Princeton, their bow ties are getting restless up there in their plaid pants. And, you know, I've been meaning to ask you about this, that, you know, we don't talk about guys on the hot seat, but I would think that he would. He's under some pressure to win, and they're struggling this season. So I could see that. Do you think there was some frustration boiling over? Or
I do. The analogy that I use is that, you know, as a coach, you spend a lot of time doing a lot of different things, and it can wear you thin. And so it almost feels like, in my mind, like an eraser. And you just have to, on the back of a pencil, just keeps getting scratched away and scratched away. And it felt like this action was akin to when you've used an eraser too much and it goes below the metal rim. And so you're erasing and you tear the paper. There are a lot of factors at play in this incident. And I think that what it comes down to is that in most people's minds, none of them matter. None of them mitigate the situation. So I mentioned that, you know, Coach Bates said that there was more to it. Certainly, you know, one of the things that has been seen is John Yazzo Scaparata's reaction to scoring a goal later in the game, then turned to the Princeton bench and gestured toward them. You know, it reinforces that this was probably not an isolated type of thing. And then even you know, beyond that, the Courier situation earlier in the season, a handful of injuries and guys that have been unavailable. The thing that I think some people have turned to and said was most puzzling is that this was still a very competitive game at this point. They had just come out from halftime, so the timing of it seems bizarre. You know, there are a couple of things that I wanted to talk to some folks that were familiar with the incident and the situation to know. You know, the first was on the video, it does not look like he's bracing for contact in a way that he's surprised. But was it accidental? Was a consideration that we needed, you know, in terms of trying to give it full attention and full consideration. The second was it jovial? Was it like a, hey, you know, that type of move?
Didn't look that way.
Well, right, and I think that, you know, it that would require a pre-existing relationship between, you know, the player and the coach that, to my knowledge, did not exist. So, you know,
the player looked, he turns around like
confused a little annoyed.
And then you can see one of the coaches, I'm not sure whether it's Madelon or, but he starts, in the clip that you can see, he starts walking over to Bates like, hey, what'd you just do?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the questions I have for you, Dan, is just in terms of your reaction to it, does it matter that it wasn't, you know, like a, you know, people that compare it to Woody Hayes need to rewatch that
different
clip. That was, I mean, he punched a player. You know, this was certainly not an acceptable situation, but the fact that he didn't do much damage, does that matter to you?
I guess it does. I guess that's part of it, sort of the severity of the
contact.
But at the same time, it's just I we both know Chris Bates, and I like him too, and he's a real nice guy. I just can't. I don't know why he did that, and it just should never happen. You shouldn't be making. People are talking about Coach K talking to a player after a game. This guy elbowed somebody during a game, so it's just it's just kind of bizarre and sad and a little depressing for me at the same time. Like it just, I wish it hadn't happened.
Yeah, no question. I don't think there is a why. I think it was one of those things that you do and you can't even explain to yourself. I mean, that's total speculation.
Yeah.
But
so it's, Princeton has you know, placed them on administrative leave pending a review of the incident, and you know, on their website it says the university is taking this matter seriously and will be conducting a prompt and thorough review. What's that mean?
Well,
what
I know
do
that
they have to look at? And
I know their athletic director was traveling on Sunday, so I think that made it difficult to make a decision about, you know, with any permanence by Monday morning. I also imagine that there's twofold. You know, first, an opportunity to speak to as many parties that were involved as possible, whether that be from just from Princeton or from Brown as well, and then discuss with other stakeholders. I think that, you know, in our climate, you want to have an understanding or an expectation of what the reaction to your final punishment or decision is going to be before you make it. I think it's very difficult to predict those things a lot of times. You know, if he were to be suspended for one game, would people be up in arms about it? Would a lot of people say, I think that's fair or justified? I don't know. And I don't think that the people who are responsible for making the decision know necessarily. I think that the other complicating factor is what we already discussed, which is, you know, are we certain that this isn't something that compounds a pre-existing issue as it relates to the relationship between Chris Bates and Princeton Lacrosse and the likelihood that it was going to continue going forward? So in that way, I can understand feeling like, let's give ourselves a little bit more time. And I think that if he's on administrative leave, I don't feel like they are under a lot of pressure to make a permanent decision.
No.
They play
Stony
Brook on Saturday. They play Lehigh midweek the following week, and then they get back into their Ivy League schedule. So
I see the Ivy League coming down with some type of punishment because it was an Ivy League game, and Princeton will handle it. I mean, the logical thing would be, say, suspended one game or something like that, and he's back on the 12th for their non-conference game against Lehigh. But then I could see the Ivy League coming back and weighing another penalty on him, and may have to sit out the Dartmouth game on the 16th.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
It's a strange...
To me, it feels like that decision will be made in conjunction. So if the Ivy League were to say he has to miss an Ivy League game, I think...
And I'm not saying they will.
I'm just saying that my presumption would be that Princeton would say, okay, then, you know, we'll choose to suspend him for three games.
So you don't think that they would say, okay, well, we'll suspend him for the Dartmouth game and then let him coach this weekend?
No, that seems awkward to me.
That's three games. That's tough, and they need these games. But you're right. They sit at 0-3 in the Ivy League, but they've played probably, arguably, the three best teams in the Ivy League already, and they have a couple of games. I mean, they'll beat Dartmouth, right? Dartmouth's struggling.
Yeah.
Struggle city. And then Harvard and Cornell, I don't...
Well, what's interesting is that when you look at their losses, Hofstra, Hopkins, Maryland, Penn, Yale, Brown. Hofstra's the only team that's not in the top 20 right now. Their win over Rutgers,
it's looking good right now.
It's looking better than it did when they beat them. I believe that was in the midst of, or maybe that started Rutgers losing. I believe they lost twice so far early this year.
3-2.
They had lost to Stony Brook 3 days prior to that Princeton game. So. But at the time, Rutgers also didn't really have a super impressive win. Beating Army in the second week of the season was their most impressive win. But now they are coming off of a victory over Johns Hopkins in the Big Ten, which we'll talk about later in the show. And on that note, Dan.
Terry, let's get to the games.
Let's do it. We're recording early, so I don't have anything sound effect-wise from a food or beverage standpoint, which is good for our listeners.
So, Terry, you were in Syracuse for this exciting game, and we have a new number one.
We do
Notre
have
Dame,
a new number one.
Which we probably should address, too. They jumped over Yale. But senior captain Matt Kavanaugh had a career-high 9 points, and 3 goals and 6 assists. So all the Kavanaugh fans who thought he was struggling, Terry, he had a breakout game in the Dome. Freshman Ryder Garnsey, another guy who's been quiet, had 5 goals, and Mikey Wynn had 4 times as the Irish set the stage for Notre Dame's biggest offensive explosion of the 2016 season.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that for me, this game starts with Notre Dame's possession advantage and relative lack of concern over Syracuse being able to make a run because P.J. Finley played so well at the faceoff X. He won 15-27. Notre Dame won 15-27. I believe he went more like 12-24, which is a victory against Ben Williams, who came in as the, you know, third-rated faceoff guy in McEwen's FOGO ratings. And I think that when you correlate those two things, you know, the fact that Notre Dame was more explosive offensively than we had seen at any point this season, you know, plus the fact that that possession advantage meant that they were going to just keep getting fed the ball, and then Notre Dame defensively didn't necessarily have to be as concerned about Syracuse reeling off 5 straight goals. it just was a perfect storm. And certainly for, you know, all the Syracuse alums who were in attendance, the Syracuse fans who were in attendance, it was disappointing. They got treated to a couple of fireworks. Few of them were at the hands of Kavanaugh, who you mentioned, who his best goal was a diving effort off of a ride. And then Kyle Trolley had one of the more memorable goals of the season. And we can talk about that in a little bit. Or are we going to talk about it now? No, we're going to talk about it in a little bit? All right, sounds good. But yeah, I think that, you know, just kind of a couple more general observations about Notre Dame in particular. When Kavanaugh is able to run past his guy and draw a slide and move the ball, he becomes the only player on his team that is able to do that consistently and effectively. I think that there's reason to believe that Ryder Garnsey will be able to do that, whether that's later in this season as he gets a little bit more comfortable. I don't know if that's the right word. Just, you know, kind of stops being a freshman a little bit more. Or if that's, you know, next year when he kind of steps into what Cav's role was and tries to emulate a little bit more of that playmaking ability. You know, Matt said in the wake of it, he has felt a little bit healthier over the last couple of weeks. And certainly that translated, in my opinion, to increased explosiveness. And then when he is more explosive and drawing slides, it creates a lot of room for his line mates. And that was, you know, particularly noticeable. The one thing I'll say that really surprised me is that Notre Dame was able to get to 17 goals, and Sergio Perkovic only had one. They scored in a couple of non-traditional ways, which we've seen Notre Dame's offense have to do in order to be successful. Austin Gase's coast-to-coast goal was one of the better examples of that. They didn't score. I don't recall a goal off the faceoff. Obviously, I mentioned they scored a couple times off the ride, and they certainly weren't overly daunting in extra man situations. But a couple of concerns coming away from it. Brendan Collins, who is kind of their second dodging midfielder, left the game in the first quarter with an injury and did not return. That being said, Garrett Eppel, a defenseman, you know, All-American quality player who was injured toward the end of the Maryland game and had not played since, played a little bit in the fourth quarter of this one. So for Notre Dame, Kevin Corrigan said late, I hope that we're on the different side of the coin from what we were on last year as we, you know, started losing guys toward the end of the season. I hope some of these young guys stepping up. Two of them that really impressed me were freshman short stick defensive midfielders, Drew Johnson and Timmy Phillips, both of whom looked very composed, able to clear the ball well, good and tough on ball. And then in addition to Apple coming back, and if they can get Collins back, and you know, they played without Nick Kashansky as well. But I think he's expected to return. You know, Notre Dame is in a position where they're building. Now, we spoke about Villanova in the context of peaking at the right time. My question is, what qualifies as too early in lacrosse? Is April 5th too early to start peaking? You know, I think that's a reasonable concern. If that is your biggest concern, well, you're in pretty good shape. But it is fascinating when you consider how impressive this win was.
Yeah, so it moves Notre Dame up from number two last week in the Cascade Maverick Division One, our media top 20 poll. And Yale wins a game in overtime against Penn, but slips two spots to number three.
Yeah, not
How's your feeling about the number one team not losing and still slipping?
I don't drop any teams if they lose. Yeah. I think that you can, if a team doesn't play up to snuff, you can kind of hold that in the back pocket and then apply it when they do lose, you know, maybe being a little bit more severe in terms of applying the wake of that loss. But I don't fault anybody. I think that you're justified in taking your own approach to how you vote in your top 20. I got in a couple of conversations or debates early in the season about the way that I voted early in the season. It's different from the way that I vote in the middle of the season. At this point, you know, one of my choices is I really value being undefeated. So I have Brown and Yale number one and number two. Another choice is that I don't drop teams if they don't lose. So even though it doesn't necessarily reflect who I think would win if they played right now or who I think is in the best chance to win, has the best chance of winning the national championship in May, two different outlooks that people take when they vote. You know, that's what I think. That's how I think polls should work, and that's how I vote.
Yeah, what a great week for Brown. Two big wins over, you know, Villanova. We thought that would be a sensational game, and it was very one-sided. 19-8 win for Brown over Villanova in Philadelphia on the main line, and then the win against Princeton 19-8, which sadly the play of Brown isn't what became the big story out of that contest, but obviously the Bates stuff that we've already covered.
Yeah, so talking to a couple of folks in the wake of it, Yazzo was a big story coming out of that Villanova game because he played really well, and then obviously also scored a goal in this Princeton game, and it's like, man, this kid's become a cult hero to go alongside, you know, some of the better-known quantities like Dylan Malloy, Larkin Kemp, and Jack Kelly, and Alec Tullett.
Terry, a couple more things from the weekend in Syracuse. Kind of leads us to our broadcast observation of the week. You had a note about some of the interviews that Kark did, and, you know.
It was a really special broadcast, and I thought that ESPN did a nice job. I had my headphones in, was able to listen to the broadcast while I was watching the game. Okay. So it was pretty cool. Yeah, I knew that they had plans, but obviously, you know, best laid plans, got to see them come to fruition. And also got an opportunity to speak to Kark on Friday night about, you know, what's unique about calling a Syracuse game, and how do you manage the perception that you might be a homer. Certainly Quinn has to deal with that a lot when he calls Hopkins games. And he said that, for by and large, it hasn't really impacted. It hasn't followed him around. He acknowledged that Saturday was going to be a little bit of a unique day. And it started the first of the, I guess, high-profile interviews that he did was in the athletic director's box with Orrin Lyons and Roy Simmons, who
That's
was
cool.
his coach. And I think that the more that we can do to reinforce as a sport the impact that historical team, that historical coach, Orrin Lyons, who is, you know, certainly one of the most globally one of the best known lacrosse advocates, as well as being a staunch advocate for the rights of Native communities worldwide. It was awesome. It was great to see. And then, you know, on a much more tangible kind of, I want to say grassroots, but it's more field turf level, I think it was really cool for lacrosse fans just to see, you know, Casey and Ron Powell standing next to each other doing an interview the way that we've seen them do so many times. You know, particularly for young fans of the sport who have lived through the Powells via YouTube, you know, their perception and understanding is going to be a lot different from mine and yours. And so it was just cool to see them, you know, live and in person on an ESPN broadcast.
My thing that stuck out to me, Terry, was Eamon McEnany calling the game, and this one particular call.
Trolley gets a step, shoots, and scores! Clang, clang, clang goes the trolley for Notre Dame!
Clang, clang, clang goes the trolley for Notre Dame, Terry. What is that? And how...
Well, you know what it actually is.
I do, and it's from, like, it's like from a 1940s song or something like that.
Ding, ding, ding goes the bell.
Because that's such a timely and reference for the young lacrosse fans watching the game on TV. But how long has he had that one chambered? All season? Like, has he been waiting to make that call forever?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not the first Notre Dame game that he's called, but Kyle Trolley has not played as well as he did with his memorable backhanded goal being not the only time he scored on Saturday night. I don't know what to say about that, man. You know,
that's just one of many Eamon-isms. That are, I don't even know, I guess it makes the game somewhat entertaining because I'm talking about it. But at the time, you're like, what? And that's our broadcast web observation of the week. Let's go to some more games, Terry. There was an instant overtime classic. This game was on Friday evening. I was lucky enough, I was having dinner with my wife and our kids in like a pizza place. And, look over, and I see that the game's on in, like, the bar area, and I talk to the manager. He throws a game on for us to watch, like, right by our table, which is really cool in Maryland. Like, if you did that in other places, they might say, well, you want me to put what on TV or what channel? But they do it, and then it's cool to watch other people in Maryland that you know are, like, people sitting there, but they take an interest in it because they're probably lacrosse fans too. It was a great game. I think I turned it on. It was 8-7. Carolina was up. Then Duke made a really nice run, four straight goals, and it looked like the tables had turned and Duke had sort of settled in, and it was going to be a Duke win. And it just went back and forth in a great game of ebbs and flows. And Finally, Carolina prevails over Duke 17-16 in overtime in front of 4,000 fans at Koskinen Stadium Friday night. Patrick Kelly scored the game-winning goal with 2 minutes remaining in the first overtime period. And it was a great game. That's my type of lacrosse game.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't able to watch all of this game because I was at the event on Friday night, but I was able to watch it in replay yesterday, another ancillary benefit of delaying this podcast. And, I mean, the first thing is, it's amazing that it was a Carolina win because, to me, you can't talk about this game without starting to talk about Miles Jones. I mean, he's just so good and so uncommon. You know, he had 5 goals and 6 assists. I think he had a point on the first 3 times he touched the ball. He was so efficient. He took 16 shots, and he scored 5 goals. That's 30% shooting almost. That's great. Only turned the ball over once on 6 assists. You know, just a hell of a game out of Miles Jones. I think that there were a couple of other storylines that emerged. Certainly bad goaltending was a problem in the first in the game in general, but particularly in the first half as Brian Balcom was replaced after 23 minutes. He made 2 saves and allowed 6 goals. And then Danny Fowler allowed 17 goals and only made 12 saves in the game, you know, a game that went to overtime. Colin Reeder came in and played better. He was stopping at 50% for North Carolina. You know, I guess that's just something to be aware of. The other side of this, too, is that, you know, it's easy. It was easier to imagine how a Duke win would impact the postseason landscape because, you know, it was another top 20 win for them. It certainly seems like Carolina has a shot or the likelihood is that they will get back into the top 20 RPI. This result is a little bit more muddling in the sense that now it kind of it really puts both teams on the bubble of at-large selection. And I think that, you know, as we this will be a compelling and an important result to keep an eye on, you know, as we move forward. But the other thing that need to shout out is Steve Pontrello. This was what they imagined when they moved him from midfield to attack this season. He looked a lot like his brother Nico, who was a overpowering force dodging from X. And the number of times that Steve Pontrello scored while continuing to run upfield with that now very familiar overhand running away shot. It was amazing. And I thought that, you know, he was a catalyst for North Carolina in terms of being able to jump out to a nice lead. He scored their first goal of the game, scored again in the second quarter, and then, you know, scored twice in the fourth quarter, it looks like, to be able to help inch their way back after, you know, as you mentioned, Duke was able to turn the tables in the second and third quarter, you know, kind of build what looked like it was going to stay a 2-goal lead throughout the entirety of the fourth quarter. But Pontrello and then obviously, as you mentioned, Patrick Kelly had a different idea.
Pontrello leads them in scoring. He's got 30 goals and 8 assists. So yeah. His play is, you know, they're going to need him in the last 3 games. It's funny to look at.
Carolina's schedule is always really funny to look at.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I just looked at the calendar. They have 3 games left. 3 regular season games set. They've played 10. It's April 5th. You know, it's crazy that I feel like we're just starting the season or maybe in the middle, but we're not. Memorial Day will be here before we know it.
And yeah, I mean, Carolina struggles with the timing of their finals, and it's why the ACC tournament is when it is, and it's why they don't play the last weekend of the regular season. So, you know, they typically have a 2-week break between, you know, their last ACC tournament game and their first round NCAA game. And, you know, I've on this, you know, in this forum and others, been, you know, pretty vocal that I think that's a big part of their postseason struggles in recent years. And if I were, you know, if I know that it's one of those things that's outside of your control if you were the coach, but, yeah, you know, I would work really hard to see if there was a way that we could schedule a game that last week of the regular season.
One of the bigger surprising results from this past weekend was Rutgers laying the wood to my Johns Hopkins Blue Jays. Rutgers starting attack unit combined for 9 goals and 8 assists to power the Scarlet Knights to a 16-9 victory over the previously 11th-ranked Hopkins Blue Jays in the Big Ten men's lacrosse opener for both teams on Saturday night. Rutgers is now 8-2 and 1-0 in the Big Ten. Hopkins slips to 5-4. It's really 2 key scoring runs, one in each half, that allowed Rutgers to take control. And when I saw the score, this game wasn't available to watch. And I think a lot of Hopkins fans might even be happy that you couldn't watch it.
Yeah, and it was up against the Final Four. I was driving back from Syracuse, so I wasn't able to see it either. I mean, you know, there are a couple things that, looking at the box score, immediately jump out. Obviously, Scapia is a top-tier offensive player and has emerged for a leader on this team. Chris Alain, with 13 saves, checking in at 60%. In this game, you know, really impressive performance. Obviously, a baseline, you know, kind of eliminated the opportunity for Hopkins to make a run in this game. But ultimately, you know, talking to a couple of people that were able to watch it, it was the type of game that, you know, Hopkins just got outplayed and Rutgers was never really threatened in. It was a thorough victory for Coach Brian Breck's team. And I think that it, you know, that coupled with the fact that Michigan took Maryland to the absolute wire means that it's going to be a really interesting season in the Big Ten. And we've got one more game from this weekend to talk about.
Jules Hennenberg scored 2 goals and had 4 assists for Rutgers. What a name.
Huh,
Jules
awesome.
Hennenberg. That Absolutely. Is brilliant. Another game, Terry, another Big Ten game. Penn State and Ohio State met on Sunday. Penn State moves 7-3 with a 6-5 victory over Ohio State at Ohio Stadium. 6 different guys get a goal apiece to pace the Nittany Lions. Grant Ament had 2 assists in a very good defensive battle. Will Schreiner in goal for Penn State really stepped up with 15 saves. Tom Carey had 13 for Ohio State in a really solid, good game.
It's funny because this is one of those things where the margin between winning and losing is so slim, but your reaction to each is so different to the winner and the loser. So for Penn State, I'm impressed by the fact that they were able to win a 6-5 game coming away from their win over Denver, in which the story of that game was a combination of faceoffs and the play of their attack. They put up 15 goals against Denver. You know, granted, I've heard a lot of people question Denver's defense, but that's still a really impressive showing. Then to be able to turn around and win this game, limiting Ohio State to 5 goals, you know, certainly an Ohio State team that has received some criticism offensively itself, you know, but it's not as if it was a totally one-sided type of affair. I mean, you mentioned obviously Will Schreiner's playing goal. Tom Carey played really well too. Both teams were made to stretch and find a little bit more about who they are. One of the hallmarks of this game and things that I'll remember, both teams went to zone and it was very effective. But ultimately, on the game-winning goal, which came with just a couple minutes left, Matt Florence, it was a step-down shot that was essentially a zone-busting shot. It just reaffirmed how both in basketball and lacrosse you beat a zone defense, and that is by shooting either over it or through it. That's what Penn State showed an ability to do. And then it felt like a scramble late. You know, it was a game that I wouldn't have been stunned if Ohio State had found the equalizer. Penn State's ability to hang on, it's one of those things. It's such a slim margin. But when you couple it with the fact that they're 7-3, when you couple it with the win over Denver, when you couple it with the fact that they're 1-0 in the Big Ten, and the Big Ten is a little bit more wide open than folks might have expected, both in the preseason and early in the season, it just feels like Penn State has a really good thing going.
Meanwhile, the Buckeyes started the season 5-1 and have now lost 5 straight.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's obviously some just turmoil issues. In the preseason, I wrote a few times that Ohio State and Coach Nick Myers were going to have to adjust to life without a dynamic, borderline transcendent offensive star.
Jesse King?
Well, Jesse King was the most recent, but, you know, preceding him, it was Logan Schuss. Prior to him, it was Joel Delgarno. Prior to him, it was Kevin Buchanan. And, you know, these are 4 guys that have gone on to tremendous success in their post-collegiate, whether it's the MLL, NLL, Canadian indoor game. And, you know, when you have a player like that to build around, it goes a long way. I think that, you know, this year, Austin Shanks has become their leading scorer. There are a couple of guys on the roster who you know, should have been better positioned to take a step forward. Carter Brown only has 13 goals and 5 assists. Colin Chell, who played pretty well against Penn State, was coming off of a really nice freshman season. He's only got 9 goals and 5 assists. So they just aren't, you know, there isn't a guy that scares you offensively for Ohio State right now. Clearly they have talent defensively. Tom Carey has been very good. You know, they benefited from a grad transfer that was one of the best faceoff guys in the country last year, and Christopher May. You know, so now they're back to being, you know, relatively middle of the road in terms of their ability to win faceoffs. So, you know, this is a well-coached team, and I know that Ohio State has a surprise or two left in them this year, because it's I feel very similar to Ohio State as to how I feel about Maryland. Like, they have shown us too much over the last 5 to 6 years to say, no, this team doesn't have it this year. They don't have a good win. They've lost 5 in a row. They still have a surprise. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to correlate to a Big Ten championship or a tournament, NCAA tournament appearance, but they've got something left in them this season, and I'm curious to see what it is. It's, you know, they got a big one coming up at Homewood against at 2 p.m. on Saturday.
Homecoming at Homewood Field.
Yeah, and then they've got another one. I believe it's a Sunday evening at Maryland on 7 p.m. I think it's a Big Ten Network game. So, you know, keep your eyes peeled for those two games.
Terry, leads us to our Twitter follow of the week, Twitter comment, and you have some thoughts on Ryan Flanagan,
well,
ESPN.
I have a question for you, basically. Yeah. So Ryan Flanagan is a very good ESPN color commentator, and he was really upset with the way that the shot clock and stall warnings were being distributed in the Ohio State-Penn State game.
Okay.
He pulled double duty with Anish Shroff, handled a 17-16 affair in Durham on Friday night, and then made the trip to Columbus and had a 6-5 affair on Sunday afternoon. And his issue is his point is well taken, and that is that, you know, the objective stall call puts referees in a position to really adjudicate and dictate teams' tempos and styles very differently. And his comment in the wake of the game was, how is it that Penn State has more stall warnings, more shot clocks put on them than Ohio State does, when Ohio State was the first to go to zone and it appeared to the naked eye wanted to play a lot slower offensively? My question for you, Dan, is one of his tweets was, if we don't, as broadcasters, harp on this point, how can we expect it to change? My question for you is it a broadcaster's job to advocate for a certain point of view?
It's not his job, but he does have a platform to make change. And I think that's what Ryan was trying to say, that, look, I have this soapbox, for lack of a better term, and I'm going to use it to hopefully bring positive change to the game and make people aware of this issue.
Is it outside of his scope? Is it improper to utilize the soapbox that way? Because not everybody agrees with him. Some people like the status quo.
I don't, and I've told you about this, and we've talked about it. I really think there should be a shot clock that is available, and it's a time thing based on when you gain possession, rather than an arbitrary thing left up to the officials. It's hard to call a college lacrosse game, and that's just one more thing that I think the officials, you know, it could be taken out of their hands in terms of when or why the stall warning and shot clock go on.
Well, and I think it's important to say at this point that it's probably not entirely within Ryan's, you know, control or discretion. I mean, I'm not saying that he doesn't think and believe the things he's saying. I think he certainly does. But I also know that not only is it hard to officiate a college lacrosse game, it's hard to watch a college lacrosse game as an uninitiated fan.
Sure.
And understand what's going on. And I think that, you know, the producers, the executives at ESPN understand that very acutely, and they are invested in trying to rectify that problem.
Yeah.
And are probably making sure that the broadcasters know that it's a problem and trying to rally support to try to rectify it.
I have a question for you. How influential do you think ESPN can be in getting that changed?
I think they can be very influential, because I think that they can make life difficult for the decision-making coaches by constantly having them chirped at by their fans and by their parents and by the other people that watch these broadcasts. Otherwise, I don't think that we would hear coaches say the things that they do about the broadcasting. They have been critical of different types of agenda pushing or mistakes made by broadcasters in the past. If they didn't think that it had the power to impact change, I don't think we would hear about it. I think that, you know, it's a broader platform and a more powerful one than Inside Lacrosse, but I've heard about it. I heard about it in the wake of the February issue from coaches that don't have a problem with lacrosse games being played in February. And their point was, you didn't do a good enough job reaching out to coaches who like February lacrosse games because you were advocating this position. I was like, okay. I mean, you know, you're probably right. We didn't. And there is some degree to advocacy that occurred in that. I think that it's the general opinion of the Inside Lacrosse staff that these games in February are bad for our sport. And I will note that that is against ourselves. You know, that is against our best interest. It is probably beneficial to Inside Lacrosse to have these games start as soon after January 1st as possible. But we just don't think it's in the long-term best interest for lacrosse, yeah. And that's why we made that issue.
So go follow Ryan Flanagan, ESPN analyst, star MLL player, defenseman.
Tar Heel, who's hurting right now.
I hadn't thought of that, but probably. He's Ryan Flanagan 24 on Twitter, so at Ryan Flanagan 24, and he'll drop some knowledge on you.
If you checked his Twitter feed last night, I believe his response to the loss was, quote-unquote, that hurts.
Yeah. Well, that was a tough one, and we've talked at length about that. So, Terry, this week, not a lot of midweek games.
Which is great for us recording this a day late. That's one of the things that has like kind of, you know, urged me about promoting this podcast late in the week is that, you know, when particularly in this year of midweek upsets, we promote a podcast that was recorded prior to the upsets. It's kind of awkward that we talk about the week in college lacrosse and don't talk about the upsets. So that's been one of my issues.
No, I agree with you. I don't know if people want this, but we could do this more often. We could probably do one.
We could.
But only a handful of midweek games. Maybe the biggest one is Bryant is playing Brown.
Yep.
And that should be a good one. But we also have a magazine that we're putting together that is deadlined for Wednesday. Yep. So the lack of a lot of midweek games makes it a little easier on our editorial staff here at Inside Lacrosse. So
thank you, coaches.
Yeah. But this weekend, there's some good stuff.
Absolutely.
The one I'll be watching, we talked a little bit about, is the Ohio State-Hopkins game. Might go, depending on what the weather's supposed to be. I think it's supposed to be very cold. But always fun to go to Homewood Field.
Smell the sausages.
For any game, but homecoming is a special thing at Hopkins. Unlike some schools, they have it in the springtime around a lacrosse game and a lot of fun festivities. Not my reunion year, though, so
no.
I might... We'll see what my wife has planned for Saturday. But on CBS Sports Network, Colgate at Navy at noon, Fox Sports Network, Denver at Villanova. Kind of like watching those Fox games. They do a nice job. I'm sorry, the ESPNU is where you can find the Ohio State-Hopkins game. Some games on ESPN3, Marquette at St. John's and Quinnipiac at Detroit. Do you say Quinnipiac or do you say Quinnipiac?
Ooh, I say Quinnipiac.
No, well, that's definitely wrong. But I think it's like a tomato-tomato thing. And then on the Big Ten Network, a game that should be very good, Maryland at Penn State on Sunday, and also on Sunday on ESPNU, they have a doubleheader. Duke at Notre Dame at noon, Virginia at North Carolina, too. Lots of ACC action.
Are we making a pick this week? I hadn't prepared that.
We can. Which game do you want to pick?
I
like Notre Dame against Duke. I like Carolina.
Virginia, Carolina, and Maryland, Penn State are the two lines that are going to be the closest.
Yeah.
I bet Carolina's a 2.5 goal favorite over Virginia. Penn State's probably a goal and a half underdog against Maryland.
I mean, Virginia's really bounced back from near death. A few weeks ago, with a couple of
shutout against Richmond that we didn't talk about,
9-0.
Yeah,
Richmond.
They need
is
your
tough.
Boy Mitch Goldberg.
Richmond is tough, and a shutout. It's so rare. When was the last time there was a shutout?
Well, there were two last year. Yeah. So Ohio State got shut out by Notre Dame. There was one previous this year. I don't remember who it was though.
But it's definitely rare. But yeah, some doubleheader action. So I like Carolina, I like Notre Dame. Don't know what the lines are, and I think I'm going to take the Terps. On Sunday night at Penn State.
So our final segment is New Words to Live By.
Yeah.
Do you have something prepared? Because if not, I got something on the fly.
No, I do.
I really liked what I had, too.
Oh, well, you want to give it?
Well, so since we're talking about betting, the old adage, life's too short, it's about the under. One of my friends may or may not have bet the over last night, which was at 149 or 149 and a half. So it's like 70 to 67 with 2 minutes to go. And I was like, how are you feeling about this? And he's like, not good if it ends in regulation. And then when did Archie go to the line prior to the page three?
I don't remember.
I think that's what happened. And I was like, hey,
I think
man,
it was somebody else.
If he hits
I think it was
one of these,
Josh Hart or somebody, or somebody knocked down two free throws.
Yeah.
And they were huge shots.
Well, it was huge for the over, too. Because yeah. I was like, if he hits these, then you get a three ball, you're good regardless. Because that puts it at 148. And either it's, you know, going over in regulation or it's going over in overtime. And he hit the free throws. We saw Marcus Paige, and then obviously we saw Jank get set up and knock it down. How do you feel about the expression 1-2 step, by the way? Kind of implies that you traveled. That's what he said. He was like, when I get my hands on the ball and it's 1-2 step.
Oh, it is a travel. They never call that.
Well, I know, but like
the guys that step into their shot, like I'm very much against that, and it should be called a travel. But I like your quote. Life's too short to bet the under. Because who roots against points? What is wrong with people who are like, hey, let's? I'd rather there not be a lot of scoring.
Well, I was listening to...
Much more fun to root for the over.
I was listening to the Pardon My Take podcast featuring Barstool Sports Big Cat and PFT Commenter. And they were talking about...
Big Cat
is a huge proponent of betting the overs and never betting the unders. And I thought PFT Commenter set him up perfectly. He's like... If we need to get you going on betting the under, what better game than Duke Yale when they played in the played in the Sweet 16?
No, it was the round of 32.
Yeah, and I don't think he pulled the trigger on that. Well, that was perfect logic to me. If there was ever a game to root against points, it was that one.
All right. Well, we can't end with a gambling quote. So Terry, I've had this one for a long time from like when we first started this segment, and it's the words of wisdom on a Chipotle bag.
Courtesy of a Chipotle bag, yes.
Yeah, so Stephen Dubner is the co-author.
What up, Dubs?
The co-author of Freakonomics. Is probably he's written 7 books, and that's probably the most famous. But I like this quote, and it's so appropriate that it comes on a Chipotle bag. And by the way, you want to get some lunch out of this?
Absolutely.
The quote is, "The world is complicated, but does every problem require a complicated solution?" And there's nothing more true than that, Terry. Sometimes you just keep it simple and look for the simple answer first.
Thanks, Chipotle. Thanks, there Dubs.
So that's it. Another week in the bag, Terry, in the Chipotle bag. See what I did there? Enjoy the games, and we'll talk to you next week.
Inside the Cross Podcast.